Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a lean, mean podcasting machine. My name's Corey Hazelhurst. I'm a partner of propaganda with Steve Haynes.
Hi, Corey.
I'm also joined for the second time in a row by Birmingham City Councillor, and I think probably the most successful Labour politician named after a piece of clothing is Councillor John Cotton.
Absolutely, stitching things together.
The only other one I can think of is Phil Willis, and you're obviously far superior to that amoral piece of garbage. So,
I think this might be the first time we've actually had you on the Phil Willis.
I think it might well be, and there's a very good reason for that.
Which we'll get into one of a bonus episode at some point.
This season of Not Enough Champagne has all been about personal responsibility. And today's episode is on the politics of obesity. One in four adults in the UK is overweight or obese. It costs the NHS £5 billion a year. So in this episode, we're going to discuss, is it the responsibility of those who are overweight to help to lose weight? Or is it a collective problem we can all try and solve? And we'll also discuss the proposed tax on sugar. Is it an effective way to combat obesity? We'll talk about that after this. The problem with issues like obesity is that often they do tend to be framed as an issue of personal responsibility, that you are fat and it's your fault and therefore it's your duty to try and sort it out. And I think actually it's a wider issue than that. I think we should be trying to frame issues like obesity as a collective problem. I was able to lose a little bit of weight over the past couple of years, and part of that is because I live in a quite safe middle class neighbourhood with a park nearby. And I'm able to go out, I'm able to exercise and go and run in that park if I'd like to. Which isn't the case for people who maybe don't have a park nearby or maybe don't have a park that's safe. If you look, for instance, in America, the group that tends to have higher levels of obesity, they tend to be black teenage girls. And obviously they're the ones who live in the kind of areas where you don't necessarily want to be out running. They tend to live in areas where actually it's not safe to go out running, or it's not safe to go to the park and run. Also, I think the changing nature of work has been a big factor in it. I know I've tended to eat a lot worse when I was on my PGCE placement. And part of that is because you're doing really long hours and you tend to be out of the house about 6:30 and you're then back about 6:30, 7 o'clock, at which point you don't have time to cook. You buy a ready meal from the supermarket and you shove it in the oven. It's never been easier to buy cheap, unhealthy food. I think that's why you've got to try and solve the issue of obesity. It's got to be a collective problem. But I think it's also an issue of class as well, because if you look at, and this is something I know we're going to talk about when we talk about a sugar tax, but it tends to be those from the most deprived areas who are overweight or obese. Now, children in the most deprived communities are twice as likely to be obese or overweight as those in the least deprived group. And even in adulthood, those who are eating more sugary things, more unhealthy things, they also tend to come from the lowest income groups. Do you agree with that assessment? Is it an individual or collective issue?
It is a collective issue. You know, the statistics you've just given there around what is absolute crisis in terms of obesity, and I think the really striking thing is the number of children who are presented as obese. Was it 1 in 4 by the time they're at the end of primary school?
Just over a quarter, about 28% by the start of reception, and then by the end of year 6, it's more like 30-34%.
Yeah. That is a social disaster waiting to happen in terms of the individual outcomes for those kids as they grow up, but also the challenges it poses for the health system as well. So I don't think you can then just turn this into a pointing the finger and saying you now have an individual responsibility. Clearly that's the result of a whole set of social factors that have created that situation. So I think we've got a collective responsibility as the state, as communities, to find ways of tackling that issue.
I don't disagree with the notion that there is a collective element to all of this. A lot of the solutions around this are going to actually revolve around government policy in one way or another. But at the same time, you need to be careful to not completely negate the individual responsibility there. Whether or not that be the individual responsibility of the parents, as well, or of just the individual who is overweight themselves. At the end of the day, as Corey alluded to, where he's lost weight by taking responsibility for his health and taking up exercise and going running. I believe you did a similar thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit blunt. As a man of a certain age, my battle with the bulge has been fought over a number of years. There's a balance to be struck, isn't there, between the individual and the collective approach. So simply assuming that people can just get on with it and it's always easy to do, it's how do we support individuals? So that's why I say there's a role for the state. There's also a community role here as well. So it is about friends, neighbours, and all of that kind of stuff. So you're working on a community basis.
No, I agree with all of that. And there are certain policies which were actually quite good, which were brought in under previous governments, which have been gotten rid of as a result of austerity and things like that, such as cheaper access to community health centres and gyms and things like that were run by the local councils, which are now basically impossible to get to unless you're going to them at 6 o'clock in the morning, which is completely infeasible for 90% of the population.
Blaming parents for the obesity of children, maybe that kind of leads us on to one issue that we could talk about in terms of the politics of obesity, and I think that's marketing. Because, as you know, Steve, it's those evil bastards in marketing like yourself.
It's true, as a marketer, I am going to hell.
But so the public
health forcing sugar on me as we speak.
Just eat it.
The Public Health England did a report a couple of years ago where a lot of the facts that we'll talk about in this episode are based on, and one of the things that they say has led to a culture, as you say, John, a collective culture of obesity, I suppose, made of cheap unhealthy food. A lot of it comes from the marketing. So things, for instance, like cartoons or celebrities endorsing unhealthy food products. But often it's very, very hard for parents to refuse children to buy the unhealthy food if it's... I mean, the McDonald's Happy Meal, I suppose, is the most well-known example, isn't it? So Ofcom have rules on advertising in children's programming.
Yep.
But children's programming only accounts for a small percentage of advertising. I think off the top of my head, it's something like 150 million out of £4 billion pounds in total is spent on children's advertising. I mean, do you accept that marketing has its role to play in affecting the choices of children and parents? And if so, is there anything we can do, like maybe trying to extend those Ofcom regulations, not just to children's food, but maybe to celebrity endorsements, cartoon endorsements, or maybe there's a thing as well I might need you to explain called Adver games, which apparently are a new thing that the young people play.
So three separate things there. Let's try and take them one at a time. Let's start off with the regulation point, just because it's probably the solidest and easiest one to kind of get into for me. I would say there probably is a requirement to update legislation, not necessarily in terms of limiting where those adverts can go in terms of TV shows and things like that. But what you increasingly do have, for instance, are basically parents who, in order to keep their kids entertained, rather than just putting on Cartoon Network or whatever, they'll put on YouTube. And they'll just and then they'll leave them there, and they'll just cycle through the various videos on there. YouTube obviously makes its money from ad revenue and from people and companies buying ads. YouTube is very good at targeting, so which means if you've got a channel which is all about kids stuff and it's keeping kids entertained, well then myself as a digital marketer, and I want to be and I want to sell to the parents, I'm going to be putting the ads in front of those kids. So there probably is an element of update to the legislation to try and do something around that. That's actually potentially quite tricky, because obviously regulations in the UK versus what would be in the US versus the rest of the world, given that YouTube, as an example, is a global website. It doesn't just operate in one country. There's a lot of work that would need to go into that. So it's not just as simply a case of include YouTube and Netflix or whatever amongst this sort of stuff. The other kind of advertising platforms. But there is definitely some work that probably does need to happen there. In terms of Adver games, again, this goes back to basically parents giving their kids something to distract them or to play in the form of their iPhone, their iPad, their Kindle, whatever it is. There will be a game which will be Kellogg's Frosted Flakes, Tony the Tiger, Tetris, or something like that. And because the kids recognise that character, they're more likely to be interested in it. So in that sense, yes, potentially the game, that is somewhere where we might want to update things and go, hang on a second, what is the best way to handle this? Because what they can literally just do is then like directly in the middle of those games, put up a little pop-up which says after you die that says you can get 50p off of your next box of this if you just show this to your parents.
So if we assume online marketing is hard, it's minefield, only people as intelligent as yourself can understand it, let's not touch it for now.
That won't stop the government.
Can we maybe extend any current restrictions that are on broadcast media to things like cinemas, to posters, to print media, to advert games? And as you say, a lot of the problem of the changing landscape we're in is that a lot of stuff is on tablet, a lot of stuff is online. But we can at least do that, and that's a relatively quick, relatively easy win.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say updating it from TV to include print would work. I'm not necessarily sure how much of an impact that would actually have, given the way that most of what we're talking about and the way that most of these things are advertised. The majority of, especially if we're talking kids, you know, most of that is very much on online or via TV.
But there's so a couple of other issues before we go on to the sugar tax issue, maybe cost and portion size. According to this Public Health England report, 40% of all the spending on food and drink is spent on foods that are on promotion. Those food promotions generally then increase the amount that you spend, or the amount of food that's bought goes up by a fifth. The example that's given in the report is family pies a packet of biscuits, and that lasts them for the week. If the biscuit is on offer, £2 for £2, then the family buys two packs, and they go through both packs in the same amount of time. They're not kind of rational. They don't think, oh, well, I'll have one this week and one next week. Generally, both tend to be eaten the same week. And also what research suggests is they're then more likely to buy a third pack of biscuits in that week as well. So with that promotion, you're tripling the amount of unhealthy food that you're buying and consuming. So you've kind of got the promotion aspect as well. But also portion size is quite interesting. One interesting stat I didn't realise, but certainly talented with my experience, is that a quarter of people who buy a big share bag of food tend to eat that alone and don't tend to share it. That's going to be me on Bike Holiday Monday watching the 97 election coverage with lots of chocolate and ice cream.
They don't call him Dr. Excitement for nothing.
Thinking about how good things used to be. But so one thing that Britain has done, cap the size of chocolate bars to 250 calories.
Well, I'm just reminded of the post-Brexit Toblerone.
Well, what happened to the...
There was a newspaper story, wasn't there, where Toblerones got smaller or there were less pieces in them. Yeah. Goes back to what you said at the start around, and this is why it's important there's a collective response and responsibility for dealing with issues around obesity. So, you know, how we ensure that manufacturers and retailers are behaving in a more responsible way than is the case at the moment, frankly. And my sort of like various things I've done that are sinful over the years, I'm an ex-smoker. And, you know, it just strikes me how we've managed to shift social attitudes around smoking over the last 25 years. So, you know, when I started smoking, I was at 16 or 17, you know, it was very widely advertised, still on the telly, you know, very, very cheap to do. And you then move to the situation we are now, where it's kind of frowned upon, looked upon entirely differently. There are alternatives available to help people move off smoking who are smokers. It seems to me we've got to try and find some similar approach around the issues of unhealthy food and over sugar in particular. What those methods are, you know, I don't have a well thought out plan for that, but that seems to be the same kind of approach that we need to take. And I think the other thing is, I'll just draw on the experience of a school in my own ward, which has started doing some really creative work with parents over portion sizes and cooking skills. So they do this, it's Hillstone School, they do this Cooking with Hillstone project where you can buy a box of ingredients for the week. They've got a chef on site who provides, you know, recipes that are healthy and, you know, you can cook for the whole family affordably over the course of a week. And it seems we need to do more of that kind of stuff as well, just to equip people with the skills they need.
From my perspective, I think the biggest kind of thing that you can do to help offer a collective kind of solution to obesity does boil down to kind of like the skills and the knowledge around these sorts of things. I think education, as in most issues, kind of the silver bullet almost that will actually resolve this stuff. At the end of the day, there's actually just really basic things which a lot of people don't know how to do. Or I mean, like I happily admit I'm slightly overweight, and I know that for the root cause of that for me is portion size. Just because I look at a smaller meal and I go, that is not enough food to get me through, so I end up doubling up, or in some instances tripling the amount of food that I should be eating on that particular meal.
So even though the portion size is on the back of the back of everything you're eating, again, this is something where regulations probably could be updated. Yeah. So rather than it being, and for this 100 grams worth of bag of crisps or whatever, it's this many calories, it should just be, this is what the entire bag is. Because I guarantee you, if you put it into that kind of terminology, people will pay attention to it and people will respond to it a lot better, because you know what that bag looks like and you know, but you and you can react to it. But with 100 grams, well, what's 100 grams of Walker's crisps look like?
Do you want to take a photo and tweet it? Yeah,
yes.
Just think that the whole area of food labelling is something that's desperately crying out for to be accessible and more simplified. You know, we can move more to almost a kind of traffic light system, so people have an understanding of what they're buying. Because you're right, you sort of look at the back of the packet at the moment, and it's largely indecipherable.
Yeah, because I mean, this is something I started doing just because, in an attempt to try and lose a bit of weight, I have been paying a bit more attention to the calories and things in the food. And over the past couple of weeks, I've just looked at some of the portions, and I'm like, how the hell am I meant to work out what 50 grams of this is? Because I'm not going to carry around a scale with me all day. I bought some flatbreads, and I checked the calorific content on them. The calorific content was per half a flatbread. It wasn't even the full one, it was a half, which is such a bizarre kind of measure to give, given that they're quite small, so people are just going to eat one. They're going to eat the entire thing themselves. But the reason it's been done as a half is because it looks a lot more appealing in terms of the calorie count, because then it's only 350 calories, say, rather than 700.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what the answer is. Do you try and regulate calorie size of flatbreads or what have you? But I mean, one good example, I think, from that is cereal, and you have recommended bowls of 30 grams of cereal or something. It's like shreddy wheat. How many bits of shreddy wheat is that of the bite size? Mm. It's like 12. Be interesting to look at sizes of plates and bowls and things as well, because I recently inherited a lot of crockery from my grandparents. If you compare the size of the plates and the bowls that they were using in the 70s and 80s, and you compare that with the size of bowls that we chucked out to have those, the bowls that we were using for cereal before, they were twice as big.
Yeah, depending on the size of your plate will determine how much food you will eat. There have been a number of studies on this, and so the bigger your plate, the more likely you are to eat more of the food. So you could serve up the exact same amount of in terms of calories on a smaller and a bigger plate, but because it's a bigger plate and it just looks like there's more there, you feel like you're absolutely, you need to eat all of it. Whilst with a smaller one, you're more likely to put, you know, less food on there, get through it all, and then go, oh, I'm finished now.
Mm.
I think actually that's where the trend more to eat out, both away from home but also in restaurants and takeaways, is interesting too. It's about 18% of meals now are eaten out of the home, whereas that was only 5% two or three years ago, which is a big shift. And I think in terms of you eat what you have on your plate, especially in a takeaway where you've probably paid more than you simply would do from a supermarket, that I came from a household where you ate everything, and you eat even though you're full because you've paid for it, and it's good manners to eat everything.
And because there are children in Africa who are starving, yeah, exactly. And what would they say if you didn't see this?
So I think it's the takeaway was, but as you say, are you going to get the large Doner meat and chips or the small one? Well, obviously you're going to get the large one, but then the large one probably has enough calories to feed a small factory in China for a day.
Yeah.
And that's before you put any sauce on it.
As I say, there's other collective stuff we can do about maybe regulating portion size. Something else that we could do that I think was proposed by George Osborne. Do you remember George Osborne?
What, you mean that esteemed editor of the...
Journalist of the Year.
Yeah.
Before he entered journalism, he was Chancellor of the Exchequer. There is no end to his talent and ambition. He proposed a sugar tax in, I think, the last budget before he was so unceremoniously dumped from office.
Bittersweet.
Some evidence from a few different countries that have introduced a sugar tax that it would work. There's a few different European countries. Actually, in the 34 states in America have introduced it as well. And I think actually in Philadelphia, in the week we're recording this, a lawsuit's been brought up by a few companies who make fizzy drinks, who put a lawsuit saying that it's illegal to tax fizzy drinks or something. So that might be an interesting thing to look at. But there's a lot of the places you expect, so places like Norway and Finland have put in sugar taxes. France have as well, who kind of tend to be more, I suppose, social democratic in the way that they approach policies like this. But then there's interesting ones as well, like Australia, you wouldn't necessarily expect. They have a 10% tax on soft drinks. Hungary as well doesn't really strike me as a social democratic bastion. And Mexico as well, because Mexico, 70% of Mexican adults are either overweight or obese. And so there was a tax. It's why a wall would be so effective, because they can't
climb to get over it, yeah.
Do you two have any particular thoughts on a sugar tax and how effective it might be?
I've got mixed views on it. I think absolutely it is something that would be legitimately part of a set of measures that you put in place to tackle obesity. But you do need all that other collective support and that sort of cultural shift stuff to happen. My one worry with a sugar tax is that you end up with the burden being placed on the poorest. And it's not actually though the like evil corporates responsible that bear the burden. It's actually those who are just struggling to get by at the bottom. So unless you've done all that, put those other steps in place so people have got affordable alternatives, the danger is that you just end up again clobbering those who are already struggling to get by, and you're not actually shifting the behaviour.
My natural instinct whenever you say it, and that we should tax it, is to kind of reel back a little bit and go, really? Taxes are often kind of utilised as a, we can fix this if we only have more money, and 90% of the issues in politics, whether it be the NHS or education or whatever, money helps, but it's not going to actually solve all the problems. So when it comes to the sugar tax, my first reaction is, really? But at the same time, I value policies that work. In fact, that was basically the entire argument that myself and Corey had on a previous episode, where we were talking about whether you should pay people to achieve certain ends and things. In fact, we discussed
losing weight, to read books,
yeah, lose weight, or quit smoking, or whatever. And then my entire argument for that was, if it works, why would you just not consider it? And if sugar taxes work, you'd be foolish to not at least consider it. And I think if it's part of a, as you said, John, part of a broader package, then I think it could be very effective. One other concern that I would have with this is that almost certainly, from a kind of a political spin perspective, the way that this would be brought in and sold is, it's, we're going to bring in this sugar tax and we're going to use the extra money from it to fund X. You know, probably the NHS, given it's a health-related thing. And that's absolutely fine on the face of it. But then you remember that actually this is a sin tax, in effect. And with sin taxes, the main aim is not to raise revenue, but to change behaviour. And if you're changing that behaviour, then that revenue stream is gone, or it's decreasing. Because for this for that policy to be successful, you're having fewer and fewer people buying fizzy drinks, and therefore you're getting less and less money from it, which means you then end up with a funding black hole, saying, well, where's this, where we've said, well, we're going to bring in X many million from this tax, therefore, where's that gone from? That money's still needed to fund whatever it was funding, but it's not going to be there anymore, because if the policy's been successful, we've all stopped that sinful behaviour. And I think that is something that is very likely to happen with the introduction of something like this in the UK. If it were to be introduced, I think it probably would work. There's recent evidence in the form of the plastic bag 5p charge that has actually changed people's behaviours. People are now cutting down on the use of plastic bags. So these things can work and do work. But it really boils down to the actual kind of the nitty-gritty details and whether or not there's anything else with it at the same time. Because, as you say, if it's just that on its own, well, all you're going to do is end up taxing poorer people more.
I think in terms of the politics of it, I think you're probably right. The reason why a sugar tax, I think, is different to what we were talking about last week, not to dredge it all up again, but in things like when you're using it for, say, getting kids to read books, you're introducing market values into places where they would crowd out non-market norms. Whereas the market for fizzy drinks is quite obviously already part of a functioning market economy. What you've got with fizzy drinks and sugar is you've got an example of a clear negative externality, in that the obesity costs the NHS £5 billion, and collectively, out of taxpayers' money, we are paying for the cost of obesity. So there's a cost imposed on people eating sugary foods and drinking fizzy drinks, which is not factored yet in the price of that good. And so I think the clear economic case for a sugar tax is there, is to meet that negative externality. That's why I find it really, really frustrating that so-called free market think tanks like the Adam Smith Institute always denigrate their sugar tax. There's some things from them that say, but a banana's got more sugar than a can of Coke, so why don't we tax bananas? To which you're obviously, well, it's a piece of fruit, isn't it, you morons? Like, what is wrong with you? I think the other thing in terms of the market for sugary drinks works like a proper market economy should do. If you do increase it, if you bring in a sugar tax, it does decrease the amount of fizzy drinks that people buy. As we talked about last week, market incentives in some parts of education don't work like a market. So if you pay people a set amount for achieving a certain grade and you increase that amount of money, it doesn't mean that more people then achieve that grade. It doesn't work like you'd expect a market to. The research from the sugar tax, at least in the short term, from these countries I mentioned before, is that actually it does lead to a decline in the purchasing of sugary goods. In Norway, at least, it was 6% decline. In Finland, it was nearly 5%. To offset what you were saying, John, about that the cost might be brought on the poor. Certainly in Mexico, where this has been brought in, the decline of consumption of sugary drinks was highest amongst the poorer income households, which maybe does suggest that hopefully, in terms of the burden, it won't hit the poor the hardest. That it's not like, say, you're taxing cigarettes and people are addicted to smoking and they'll still buy the cigarettes regardless of the tax. People's habits change. And actually, in Mexico, there's been an uptake of the amount of bottled water that people are buying as a result of this charge being brought in, which is hopefully a sign that it won't end up being a regressive tax. The other thing that's happened in Hungary is apparently manufacturers have altered their standards. And I wonder if that's maybe the point of a sugar tax. As you say, I think in terms of the politics of it, ring-fencing that money for a particular purpose is the wrong way to go about it. You have to present it as a sin tax. But I wonder if you do have a tax per sugar, which leads manufacturers to change their standards, that might be a good outcome. Mm. It's happened with salt. The amount of salt in our bread has declined by 40% since the 80s. It's not led to a consumer outcry. People have just incorporated it into their diets. And I think if sugary drinks had less sugar in it as a result of this tax, that's a win for everyone, I think.
Wouldn't disagree with a lot of that. I think it's just important where the burden falls. Mm. And if it's falling in the right place, there are, you know, alternatives. Clearly with sugary drinks, there are alternatives to the full fat Coke. And you can do a lot of that really good nudge work by using the tax in that sensible way.
Right? Yeah. And again, to kind of take this kind of back to where we kind of started the discussion with marketing and things like that, and I think one of the interesting things would be is that when you're talking about full fat Coke and things like that, is that Diet Coke isn't viewed as a manly drink. For instance, it's a drink which a lot of women drink, hence why Coke had to bring out Coke Zero, because blokes weren't buying it. Genuinely. It's absolutely bizarre. Clearly,
makes zero sense, you might say.
Indeed. There needs to be some kind of work done somehow. It's not regulation, because you can't really regulate effectively this sort of stuff. You can't regulate every single kind of thing for lack of a better term, toxic masculinity or whatever, not in a effective way. There needs to be some way to change the discourse within those kind of campaigns. Now part of that will just be different people getting involved, younger people eventually rising up the ranks as they get older and progress their careers and adapting the situation to new markets and the new situations they find themselves in, because marketing is a very adaptive sector, as it needs to be to survive and actually be effective. If you really want to start seeing things change, that's where it needs to. There needs to be a way for some kind of collective engagement that would look to shift, not necessarily the rhetoric, but the way that people engage with brands and the way that brands engage with people.
That discussion on discourse and consumer behaviour, I think, leads us really nicely to our chat on climate change and personal responsibility for climate change. So maybe we should leave this there. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. That's used on license from Creative Commons. Our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. You can follow me at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Centre Radical.
And I'm at Councillor John Cotton.
If you can tell whoever you can, however you can, about these podcasts, that would be wonderful. We have Fabian podcasts coming out about the mayoral election as well, so give those a listen, and we'll speak to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.